This Week in Enterprise Tech talks about flawed code, zombie sites, zero days, a neighborhood keeper, and how the mainframe is a living, breathing computer. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 314, recorded October 26, 2018. Mainframes are far from dead. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Slack. Slack is a collaboration hub for work that makes sure the right people in your team are always in the loop and key information is always at their fingertips. Learn more at slack.com. And by Avnet. Avnet and Not Impossible Labs created a historic event at the Life is Beautiful Music Festival, a first of its kind, live concert that helped the deaf and hearing communities experience music in a whole new way. Visit avnet.com/music1 to see the journey. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/enterprise.
Hello, welcome to another episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech, the place where enterprise professionals and those who want to be come to learn all there is to know about what's happening in technology for the business world. I'm your host, Kurt Franklin. You probably noticed from the change in hairstyle that I'm not Louis Maresca. He'll be back with us next week. But for this week, I'm here to help guide us through what promises to be a great show, aided quite ably by two so far unindicted co-conspirators, the two Brians, Brian Chee and Brian McHenry. First off, we have Mr. Brian McHenry of F5 Networks. Brian, welcome to the co-host desk at Twyatt.
Hey, thanks, Kurt. It's good to be back.
So we were talking earlier about the weather. What's going on in your part of the world? Anything exciting, cold, wet, dusty, locusts? What's going on?
Actually, in New Jersey, I believe I missed the vote, but apparently we all elected to have only two seasons, summer and winter. So we went straight from 70-degree weather last week into 30-degree weather this week. So I'm a little confused, but I guess I'll have to break out the winter jacket sooner than I expected.
Well, congratulations on not going through all that silly half-season stuff. Well, joining me as well is the other Brian, Mr. Brian Chee. Cheebert, how are things where you are? Gee, you seem strangely close at this point.
I am currently in Tampa. I'm actually two floors below Kurt in the Hilton at Tampa Airport, enjoying the Florida weather.
Well, we are enjoying the Florida weather, and now it's time for everyone to enjoy the next section of the show. It's time for the blips. So, want to make sure you're quickly correcting code flaws? Better try you some DevOps. Knowing a vulnerability severity won't tell you much about how quickly that vulnerability will be fixed, but knowing what kind of development model your company is using could tell you a lot. In the 9th edition of Veracode's State of Software Security report, they conclude that the greatest indicator of how quickly an organization will fix the vulnerability it finds correlates to how many times each year developers scan their code for issues. That correlates with just whether they're using DevOps or the old waterfall method. DevOps is dramatically better at fixing flaws quickly than the good old waterfall method. In the overall enterprise population, it takes about 14 days to get to 25% of the most severe flaws fixed and 206 days before three quarters have been corrected. But in the population that scans their code 300 times a year or more, they fix a quarter of the flaws within 3 days, half within 5 days, and 75% within seven days. Now, by comparison, if you're only scanning once or twice a year, getting to the 75% mark takes almost 4 years.
Well, I'm stepping to the side just a bit and highlighting the experiment with an Internet 2 community to use a combination of GitHub and Ansible to help handle network configuration workflows and configuration automation. Well, the gist is using a webhook, kind of like what Ansible does, to do diffs between stored and running configurations. While there are certainly security issues if you're not using GitHub Enterprise, meaning you're using the public GitHub, and consider this an experiment to smooth out having to manage multiple network configurations and shops where there are potentially several cooks in the GitHub kitchen. Well, the caveats involve someone knowledgeable on version control systems and network devices that have these types of API hooks. The demonstration I had at the Internet 2 meeting was absolutely spectacular. I was getting some of the functionality that I would have in very, very expensive network configuration utilities, but with open source. So kind of neat. So my spin on this base question of why haven't we heard more about open source solutions rather than the proprietary? Well, as our networks become dramatically more complex with adoption of technologies like SDN, such tools are actually going to become necessary even for smaller organizations, especially as technologies like NetConf for remote configuration management are becoming more widely available on various network devices. I do have to admit that isn't quite up to bare metal installs yet, but maybe it's time to get on to the early bandwagon so that you have time to eat the learning curve. What's that? Yeah, maybe Yang, OpenConfig. But automation is definitely coming. And yes, I am reaching out to the folks at Red Hat Ansible to try and get them onto the show and actually do a demo so that, you know, maybe you can get a peering into the crystal ball that is automated configurations.
Well, the software supply chain is under attack now too. Hardware supply chain attacks have been a hot topic since the Bloomberg report about Supermicro motherboards was published a few weeks ago. Software supply chain is no stranger and is also under attack as endpoint systems, whether desktops, laptops, servers, or mobile devices, continue to improve security against malware and user awareness improves against clicking on things they shouldn't. Attackers have begun looking harder for other ways to get their nasty bits of code on our systems. Since many endpoint security solutions rely on digital signing and other methods of verification of source images to avoid compromise, attackers have worked to get the malicious code inserted into a software image before it ever ships. This means that perfectly legitimate software images sourced directly from a software publisher and digitally signed with the publisher's own key can still contain damaging code. Software and updates from trusted developers have been compromised, but such an attack can easily bypass most verification mechanisms. Dan Gooden at Ars Technica details how software publisher Vesta CP, maker of a popular server hosting control panel app, was poisoned with ChaCha DDoS, a new strain of DDoS malware. His report also details another compromise of the official Python code repository with a lookalike package of the popular Colorama module. The infected version of the module spells Colorama with a very British U in color. In most cases, the compromised software was in use or available undetected for weeks, if not months. Consider scanning your installers and images, even from trusted publishers.
So we're getting close to Halloween, and abandoned websites are haunting corporations. Old web applications don't go away. They linger and spread security vulnerabilities around their organizations. These ghost sites are critical assets for criminals and critical weaknesses for enterprises, according to a new report by Hightech Bridge, a web security company. According to the report, 70% of the Financial Times 500 can find information for accessing old websites for sale on the dark web, and 92% of externally facing web applications have exploitable flaws or weaknesses. This means a U.S. company has an average of 85.1 applications that can be easily discovered externally and are not protected by two-factor authentication, strong authentication, or any other security control aimed at reduced application accessibility to untrusted partners.
Are you still running TLS 1.0? You shouldn't be, really. So anyway, Apple, Google, Microsoft, and Mozilla have announced a unified plan to deprecate the use of TLS 1.0 and 1.1 early in 2020. TLS, aka the Transport Layer Security, is used to secure connections on the web. TLS is essential to the web, providing the ability to form connections that are confidential, authenticated, and tamper-proof. Well, maybe. This has made it a big focus of security research, and over the years, a number of bugs that had significant security implications have been found in the protocol. Revisions have been published to address these flaws.
And another zero-day Windows flaw has been published on Twitter. Sandbox Escaper, the Twitter handle of a researcher who back in August tweeted out a Windows privilege escalation bug, has published another unpatched Windows flaw on Twitter. The new bug has some similarities to the previous bug. Windows services usually run with elevated privileges. Sometimes they perform actions on behalf of a user. And to do this, they use a feature called impersonation. These services act as if they were a particular user's set of privileges. After they finish that action, they revert to their normal privileged identity. The bug works as a call to delete a file that is improperly impersonated, ultimately giving regular, unprivileged users the ability to delete any file on the system, even those that they should have no access to. The bug affects the data sharing service, which was only introduced with Windows 10. So the bug only affects Windows 10, Windows Server 2016, and Windows Server 2019. The trend of publishing these security bugs via social media is likely to continue, even in light of bug bounty programs put in place by major players like Microsoft, Google, and others.
Finally, a security company is telling us all how to recognize the bots that follow us. Earlier this summer, a pair of researchers at Duo wrapped up a project investigating how they could detect Twitter bot characteristics. In their research, they discovered an initial list of fake followers and leveraged that list to unearth a botnet made up of at least 12,000 Twitter accounts. Instead of hunting fake followers on an individual basis, the researchers decided to consider the full social networks and found that the botnet they were watching began to use fake followers to trick people into thinking spoofed Twitter accounts were real. Once they found a small group of fake followers, they could branch outside that network and look for other fake accounts. The two point out that the large groups of fake followers have patterns that are easy to recognize. It's the small groups that are much more subtle to find. Well, that does it for the blips. We have some bites and a wonderful guest coming up. But before we get to our next section, well, we're going to hear from Louis Maresca telling us about a great advertiser here on Twiat.
Well, thanks, guys. Before we get back to this week in Enterprise Tech, we have to thank a great sponsor of the show, and that is Slack. And I can tell you, Slack right now is one of those sponsors that definitely relates to a lot of things that we do here. If you haven't used Slack before, it's one of those collaboration hubs that brings together almost anybody. There's so many ways you can use Slack. I've used it a ton of ways before. I've had numerous groups kind of collaborate together, whether it's IT or operation teams, as well as engineering, development groups kind of brought together in a set of channels. Everyone organizes their conversations into real-time messaging. It's a really kind of great place to be for collaboration. Plus, now that video and voice is also as part of Slack, as well as file sharing, it really provides a really unstoppable set of features that really ensures productivity. Why use email? Save time. Go back. Search all. Gain all the historical context that's inside of Slack. Slack brings that rich environment for keeping people up to date with what's going on. You can create a new channel for new issues. You can show alerts for real-time updates in the channels. Because Slack integrates with all these other systems, it brings the information to you. You can get the data from Jira, Salesforce, Zendesk, Google Drive, or even hook it up to any one of the webhooks of your applications or services, and it generates and creates a collaboration hub for you. Slack keeps teams together and ensures the way they communicate efficiently and stay productive every step of the way. Now imagine your sales team, they get together on Slack, they chat about the latest products, they keep everyone up to date and educated on what they're selling, they share new prospects, but maybe you missed that meeting. Maybe it's time to go back and review all those notes. You can go back, historically review all the context and the chat sessions and the messages later, stay up to date, have a place to go and find that information. It's really just a great hub to use as a collaboration engine. Now, having used Slack, I can tell you they have some great features. They have Slack Threads, which is also a really cool feature. You can kind of have a one-off conversation to the side. You can start new conversations. It's really kind of a great place to be. Plus, you can also do really great advanced searching. You can have search modifiers allow you to search in channels from somebody before or after a date. It just creates a really great place to go for that historical context. People of all generations have used Slack. I know that people have used it for reunions, handling different events or different facets of events, sales teams, product support people. Slack just makes it easy. It also, there's tons of public communities too, different organizations. Like, I've joined Dev Chat and Designers and UX Space Chat to kind of just chat with different people from the industry about different things that are going on. So it's really kind of a great place. Plus, they have a really great ecosystem for strong apps. You want more functionality integrations? Well, there's Jira, Salesforce, Zendesk, and more. Over 1,000 apps, ways to integrate your system. It's a super thriving dev community and great place to be. And of course, all the webhooks are available to you as well. It works anywhere. It has iOS, Android, Windows, Mac apps, and more. Over 200,000 developers use Slack to build what they need to increase their productivity and collaboration. It's just why it's just a great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, because it just really brings the collaboration back to enterprise. So great sponsor and great application. I it not only reduces my emails, it kind of streamlines my communication, it saves time, and it increases productivity. With Slack, your team is better connected. Learn more at slack.com. That is slack.com. And we thank Slack for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now back to you guys.
It's time for the bites. The first one, well, it's interesting because it's looking at a novel way to find local threats. Dragos, the threat detection and response platform, is something new because Dragos, which develops these things, has announced a partnership with the Department of Energy to develop Neighborhood Keeper. Together with Ameren, First Energy, the Idaho National Laboratory, NERC's EISAC, and Southern Company, which is a huge utility, electric utility in the Southeast, Dragos will begin to research and develop novel methods to make ICS threat analytics and data accessible to smaller infrastructure providers like co-ops and municipality providers. Basically, what they're trying to do is take the kind of analytics and threat detection that the very large companies, the very large critical infrastructure companies can use, and make them available to the smaller utilities. Goal of Neighborhood Keeper, they say, is to develop a zero trust and non-privacy invasive way of sharing threat insights from ICS and operations technology networks in near real time. The platform will be deployed at near cost. That means only eye-watering expensive and not something that's jaw-dropping to the smaller infrastructure providers who often, they say, don't have the resources for advanced technology. So, Chibert, I want to turn to you because I know you have done some significant work with the electric utilities there in Hawaii. What kind of threat analysis do you think that these smaller utilities would like to have if it doesn't cost a king's ransom?
Well, I think a lot of the problems with small utilities is they're very heavy on power engineers, and a lot of the small companies haven't made the shift to trying to integrate kind of a crossover, let's say a melding between the IT world and power engineers. So I'm starting to see a little bit of that at the Hawaii Natural Energy Institute and seeing the two cultures clash. But I'm also starting to see a new generation that are more interested. So instead of having this old attitude of everything has to be isolated, we're starting to see more and more integration of smart meters, smart switches, smart earth transformers, more intelligent substations. But what we need to do is a lot of these smaller groups need to start integrating in security right from the get-go instead of just, oh, it's really cool, let's go and see what the new vendor has. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what these guys do with Neighborhood Keeper, because I'd like to see a lot more attention of security towards the edge instead of just at the core, which has been very traditional in a lot of power engineer mentality. You know, I don't necessarily say it's the wrong thing to do, but I think what we need to do is take a lot of look at designing in the security. Maybe even do what I'm starting to see some things happening with computer science programs actually working on the Internet of Things for smart meters and to go and help build the power models. Because without good power models, a lot of energy doesn't happen. And as we start getting further into the edges, we're going to need to protect the integrity of those models. So neighborhood keeper looks like a keeper, you know, realistically. And I love the fact that the Department of Energy is getting so involved and things like, you know, the National Lab infrastructure to try and leverage a lot of this information, a lot of this knowledge, and a lot of the youthful ideas that are coming out that could go a long, long way to protecting our national infrastructure.
Well, I think that protecting the national infrastructure is critical. And one of the key aspects of this are the analytics that they're promising to use. Now, Brian McHenry, Bam, I want to talk to you because it seems to me that these analytics could be a truly critical piece. How complex do you see the analytics piece of something like this being? Are they going to have to go way out on a limb with the analytics, or is this pretty run-of-the-mill stuff that's just being applied to a new area?
So the first thing you have to consider is the source here. Robert M. Lee, who's the CEO over there at Dragos, he's also a national cybersecurity fellow. He's a policy guy, but he also comes from the NSA and has a background in ICS and SCADA. So this is a very well-respected individual who really understands the problem space. And somebody that I've happened to follow on Twitter and seen him talk at conferences as well. And if Robert's out there saying this stuff works and it's going to provide value, I tend to believe him. Although underneath all of this, there's got to be some probably pretty significant machine learning. They've probably got a lot of traffic data samples in order to be able to detect anomalies and really provide valuable analytics that really aid in threat hunting on this critical infrastructure type of networks. I think you know, to echo what Chi had to say was, threat hunting in general, not just in the energy industry, but in general, is really a nascent practice in most organizations. Even in large enterprises, they're just starting to get their arms around what does it mean to have a threat hunting team. You know, do we even have the capacity to add that in addition to even a traditional SOC if they happen to have a security operations center? So, but I do think it's a critical practice. But if what they're promising here is really something that's easy to use, that plugs right in and provides you value right up front and helps you detect these sorts of anomalies and detect where something might be going wrong or something might be getting compromised, that's a really encouraging sign and something that I really think we should be pressing on as an industry, because we're pretty sure that most things are in some state of compromise. And we've got to get better at hunting them down and finding them and not being reactive to what we know attacks look like.
Well, being reactive, it seems to me, gets into some of the practices. And Chibert, I want to come back to you, because one of the things they say they want to do is to inform best practices through the use of this data and analytics. From what you've seen in your work with the utilities, how much development still needs to happen on best practices before these utilities get to the level of most of the enterprises we've seen?
Well, I think there needs to be more cross-pollination. To say that I have run into brick walls is an understatement. There's a lot of inertia within the power industry on allowing you to touch. You know, let's even go as far as saying there's a level of paranoia within the power industry. And my answer really is the IT world has been dealing with this for a long time. And even though we've got some very nasty stories hitting about breaches, a properly designed system can have interaction. You know, I don't necessarily mean let's go and put the control room on a public portal. No, I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that, you know, as we interconnect more things and gather the data on how the operations work, what is expected, I'm even thinking, gee, you know, having some, you know, AIs, ooh, what a concept. Things that happen out of the norm sounds like a really good use case for an AI application. In fact, Kurt and I, when we were at the Gartner Symposia, went to a briefing on the Google AI, and I'm looking at using it for things on my underwater observatories. But it's also something that could be applied very nicely to power. So in developing best practices, maybe we could leverage the technology. So the complaint I hear from a lot of power guys is it's hard to see the forest from the trees. Well, maybe, just maybe, we can take a page from the IT world and use an AI so we can start looking at a larger and larger swath of data and have the AIs help us see the forest from the trees so that we can have get a better grip on what it is operationally. And when you know what it's supposed to look like, maybe identifying abnormalities gets easier. Isn't that kind of what we do in the IT world, Bam?
Yeah, Cheever. It definitely is what we try to do. I'm a little cautious on AI, and Specs in the chat room echoes exactly what I wanted to say, is that we got to be really careful about AIs and machine learning models, because we have to train them on traffic that isn't already compromised, on networks and infrastructures that aren't already breached, which can be, you know, hard to verify that we're you know, not, as I mentioned before. But and in the case of the energy industry, ICS and SCADA, there's just not a lot of data out there to train on to get, you know, even if you have a network that you can verify isn't compromised. So, you know, while I'm excited by the promise of AI helping us deal with the lack of time and resources that we have as the humans administering and engineering these infrastructures, I'm cautious because we've really got to, you know, have good, clean data sets to train those machine learning models and artificial intelligence engines with, so that we can know what an anomaly actually looks like.
Well, this is one that I'm sure we're going to be talking about again because, well, it's something that more and more governments and more utilities are going to be exploring. But before we go too far, we do have another bite that we want to touch on briefly because I know it's a subject that's near and dear to Cheebert's heart. If you don't like Comcast, it turns out Verizon, well, they might help you out. It looks like they could sell you 5G-based home internet, which could have some real implications for companies trying to sell them services and their employees. Verizon is targeting cities dominated by cable, saying that, well, customers are demanding competition. Launch cities that Verizon has targeted include Houston, Indianapolis, Los Angeles, and Sacramento. It says that Verizon say that they're targeting cities where cable is today, just foundationally, because we definitely see the customer demand in those places, according to Chief Technology Architect Ed Chan. Now, Brian, I want to turn to you because you've often talked about wireless internet to the home. Do you think that this is going to be one of the real steps that takes us in that direction? Or is this another one of those promising things that's going to be only in certain select markets?
I see 5G in kind of two ways. One, I think it's an excuse for Verizon to go and put more pressure on municipalities. You know, we talked in a previous show about how the FCC is making noise about forcing municipalities to give a certain number of pole attaches to internet service providers, especially wireless internet service providers. I think Verizon might be using this as a lever. But on the other hand, I happen to be working with a lot of wireless internet service providers, and that same FCC legislation is going to help us. And there's a lot of places, let's use my hometown of Honolulu as an example, where we have 2- and 3-story brick walk-ups. A lot of the larger companies like Spectrum and even Hawaiian Telephone have bypassed them with the high-speed internet. They'll still give you the low-speed DSL or the low-speed cable, but if you want to have gig services or, heck, even the, quote, high-speed 300 meg services, those fiber services have bypassed a lot of the smaller apartment buildings. And I think the same thing goes in a lot of other major metropolitan areas where the large providers are trying to go and hit the big skyrises where they know they can make a lot of money. But the small guys, the small apartment buildings are suffering. And sadly, a lot of those small apartment buildings are also the underserved, the folks that, you know, maybe don't make six-digit incomes and they can't afford to move to a better area. You know, we can go on and on and on. Hey, it doesn't matter. But basically, 5G and other wireless internet service providers have some really interesting positive things. And that's, you know, getting to the underserved public. And if Mo was here, she would probably go off on a major rant saying, hey, I live just outside a fairly, she lives just outside a fairly major Texas city, but she's far enough out into the country that her only alternative is LTE. So, well, maybe 5G someday in the future. Don't know. Cross my fingers for you, Mo.
So my take on 5G is that it could actually replace wireline internet. So for the folks out there that haven't been following this technology development really closely, 5G actually promises to solve the biggest problem with wireless connectivity, which is latency. Really looking at LAN-type latency, things that we're used to with only a cable provider. Now, the caveat I have, and don't get me for a Verizon fanboy here, the caveat I have is that if we let Verizon enter this market, we've got to put protections in place to make sure Verizon doesn't dominate this market for 5G and push out any other providers by, you know, getting all the pole attaches and making sure that, you know, AT&T or Sprint or whomever can also provide some competition. Because ultimately, for someone like Mo, we don't want her in a position where she only has one choice of wireless internet provider that's low latency as well. So really, we even in these underserved areas, we got to make sure that 5G is available through multiple different paths, so we're not, you know, in the same boat with a different medium as we are now with the cable and DSL providers.
Well, once again, this is one of those topics that, well, we're going to visit often because it affects so many companies, so many of their customers, and so many of their employers. But we've got a great guest. We want to leave plenty of time to talk with her. Before we do, though, let's hear once more from our host, Louis Maresca, and another great Twiat advertiser.
Thanks, guys. Well, before we get back to This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have another great sponsor to thank, and that this time it's Avnet. Now, Avnet brings new meaning to groundbreaking technology, and it makes it more accessible to everyone. Now, Not Impossible Labs has had an idea for tech that could basically revolutionize live music. Now, the team wanted to bring the experience of a concert to a group who had traditionally found it inaccessible, which is essentially the deaf community. Now, no doubt, live music for people who can hear can sometimes be taken for granted. Now, it's an experience like no other because live music can affect all of our senses. And this is where Avnet took on the challenge to make this experience more accessible to everyone, including the deaf community. Now, with Avnet as their guide, their idea evolved to one of the most sophisticated wearables on the market to help bring that shared live concert experience. It's called Music Not Impossible. The product allows deaf and hearing concert goers alike to literally feel live music through advanced vibration technology and experience together for the first time. Now, those wearables are truly wearables in the strictest sense. As part of the experience, you wear a vest and the components send vibrations through the ankles, wrist, and chest. Now, the hearing able receive music vibrations through the ears, while attendees who are deaf are wearing these wearables and receive those vibrations throughout other parts of their body, allowing them to respond to the live music alongside anyone else. Now, for many, this is an experience of a lifetime. It's an innovation that literally opens up a whole new world of music exploration for those who might not hear in the traditional sense. Now, Avnet and Not Impossible Labs revealed Music Not Impossible at Life is Beautiful Music Festival in Las Vegas last month, and it was an instant success. This kind of innovation was brought to the finish line because of Avnet. I love having amazing and inspiring tech sponsors like this for this week at Enterprise Tech. Such a cool technology. Visit avnet.com/music1 to see the journey. That's avnet.com/music1. And we thank Avnet for their support of this week in Enterprise Tech. Now back to you guys.
Well, now it's time for the best part of Twilight, and that's when we bring our guest on board. This week, we have Ms. Jamie Thomas, who's responsible for strategy, development, and client experience for IBM's Power mainframe and storage offering. Jamie is general manager. She's responsible, well, for all kinds of things, including watching the trends that exist around the mainframe space. She also tends to look at what the enterprise needs to be aware of and prepared for in things like AI, cloud, blockchain, and security. Well, Jamie, thanks very much for joining us this week here at Twilight.
Oh, guys, Kurt, Brian, and Brian, thanks for having me as well on a rainy afternoon here in North Carolina. It's great to talk with all of you.
Well, I'm going to start with the first question that most people have, and that is this. Aren't mainframes yesterday's news? Are there really still new deployments going on for mainframes, or is IBM just in the business of caring for an aging group of customers on this one?
Well, I can assure you all and all the listeners that mainframes are definitely alive each and every day, both from an existing workload perspective and, of course, new workload. In fact, our mainframes are running about 30 billion transactions a day, 6 trillion payments a year. And I can tell you, because I own client support, it continues to be busy 24/7. On a continual basis. And certainly, while we're responsible for, you know, all the financial systems and airline reservations and all that cool stuff around the world, we do have a lot of clients onboarding new workloads, particularly in the focus of a Linux-type workloads, which is an area that we've invested for quite some time.
Well, I do want to get to that whole Linux area with you, but before I do, I have to ask a question. You were talking about the transactions. And mainframes are traditionally transaction processing monsters. I mean, if you really need to move transactions by the boatload, a mainframe's a great way to go. But a lot of the computing news these days has been around analytics. So how are mainframes, when it comes to OLAP, online analytics processing, as compared to their traditional OLTP or online transaction processing?
Well, as you said, the strength of the machine is around transactions, of course, in the case of Z14 encrypted transactions, which we increased by 9x speed factor, if you will. But from a machine learning perspective, where we see the use cases is utilization of the combination of the transaction with the data that's resident on the machine, if you will, to really improve the time to do things like fraud detection at the point of sale, at the point the transaction is really taking place. That combination of the transaction speed with the data that's already on the system and using machine learning techniques allows a credit card organization or whoever you are really to achieve the outcome in the right amount of time. And I can tell you, I'm a shopper. It's one of my big hobbies. And so I test out this capability all over the world on a regular basis. So it does work quite well.
Well, when it comes to these systems, these big power systems now, Do you find that most of your deployments are people who are still using the traditional IBM monolithic mainframe operating systems? You mentioned Linux, and I remember a number of years ago looking at what was at that time an IBM Z system as the platform for a Linux farm, looking at costing out that versus a giant fleet of white box Intel-based machines. Do you really see people using your mainframes as, well, as monolithic Linux farms these days, or am I missing deployments entirely?
No, they absolutely, they do. Some of our clients, of course, that have that ZOS base, they'll utilize Linux on 1LPAR, perhaps in combination with ZOS. Linux is where you find a lot of those new workloads because that's where all the open source being developed. And once you've done it, open source one flavor of Linux, of course, it works well on the Z Linux flavors. And we definitely see clients doing really unique workloads. So our new clients in total, if you're a net new client, it typically is all Linux workload that you're bringing onto the mainframe, and you're using it as this mega cloud, if you will. It does support 2 million containers, for example, in the Z14 form factor. So you get a lot of high availability and resilience without a lot of, you know, additional effort if you're putting in a large cloud Linux environment.
Now, you mentioned something there I'd like to get some clarification on. You mentioned the Z14 form factor. For our listeners who might not be familiar with this, you know, sort of packaging, physically, what are we looking at? What is a Z14 form factor translate to in terms of, you know, data center floor space?
Okay, so this is a standard mainframe form factor in the case of the Z14. When you look at our other version of this machine, we have a machine called a ZR1, which actually is a slim version of the mainframe, and that comes in a standard 19-inch form factor, which is revolutionary for this machine. So you get all the same capability, but in that standard form factor. And in fact, a lot of our new clients, those Linux clients that I mentioned, they're going for that ZR1 form factor, which is that industry standard format. But we have both formats available, depending on what you're trying to achieve with this machine. I would say that even though it's slim, it's still quite heavy. It's got a lot of capability packed in that machine. I think it's still about 2,000 pounds, even in its 19-inch slimness, if you will.
Well, I'm about to give an insight into both my ignorance and my age and ask, when you're doing one of these, do you still have to pipe chilled water into it?
Well, there's different cooling options with these machines, and that depends on what the client desires. So we still have flexibility. In the case of the ZR1, we met many of the new ASRI standards, of course, for data center energy consumption and all of those things. We spend a lot of time on testing for different compliance algorithms around the world. As you probably know, these things are famous for being earthquake proof and tilt proof and all those wonderful things as well. A lot of our clients do take advantage of that, not only for earthquakes, but construction needs and all these kind of things that are happening in a lot of these emerging cities around the world.
Well, Let's talk a little bit. You're talking about emerging cities and emerging companies. When a company comes to you and says, I'm thinking about going with one of your power systems, what defines that company? Are there any commonalities in the kind of companies that will come to you? Are they typically coming off of a set of, you know, Linux white box servers? Are they tending to add a mainframe as one aspect of their total computing environment? Can you give us some insight into what brings a company to your door saying they want to talk mainframe?
Well, what we're seeing in some of these new use cases, a lot of them, frankly, are centered around healthcare issues, right? Healthcare, pharmacology, new large regional hospitals in parts of the world where having 8 million people in one city is very common. You see the need to have just a huge number of records and access combined with that resiliency and capability around new workloads on Linux. So you can use the same programming model, but you're getting a lot of data center operational characteristics you really don't have to do a lot of extra work to achieve in terms of HA and things of that nature. So it's really interesting to see that it's a combination of those industries. It's not just standard financial, it's insurance, regional insurance, hospitals, pharmacology, and a lot of healthcare that we're seeing in these new client sets.
Well, I am fascinated by the whole healthcare aspect, but I am curious because traditionally one of the aspects of having a mainframe sitting on your data center floor was that you had to have a pretty good idea of what your workload was going to be. You had to have a pretty good idea of what the growth curve for your workload was going to be. And I know that there are some companies that, well, they got into trouble when some of their business units would go out and contract for a cloud service that reached back and started touching their mainframe for a lot of data when they hadn't planned on it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you have to teach your customers when it comes to projecting what their workload is to be so that they can work with the financial realities of going to a mainframe solution for part of their architecture?
Well, of course, whenever we embark on a new opportunity, we do work with the customer to understand the workload characteristics and what they can expect out of the machine on their total cost of investment, if you will. We've also, with this machine, though, provided a lot of different flexible pricing options that are workload-based that have allowed some of these clients to have more flexibility. So that's part of the what we offer. In addition, you may know that we actually do run mainframes in our cloud services environment as well, particularly in support of our blockchain, our secure blockchain environment. I heard you guys talking about blockchain a little bit earlier. That is already reflected in a different pricing model altogether in terms of blockchain as a service in the cloud using those security capabilities of the mainframe.
I'm going to go all fanboy on you. I got my start in 360 30 days, 370. Love mainframes, been there, miss them a lot. But one of the questions I know our viewers are definitely going to want me to ask is, do you have a way to compare the Z series mainframe, maybe the ZR1, to say a cluster of VMware machines? You know, how do we compare apples to apples when we go to talk to our managers to say, hey, I think it might be time for us to go and talk to IBM and maybe a mainframe makes more sense? Let's have some ammunition to help them out on that.
Yeah, well, I think it's, you know, goes back to some of the scale characteristics, right? Certainly, when you look at the encryption capability, there is nothing that can compare to this because it's an EAL 5 plus machine that provides security at all levels of the system, all the way from the top of the stack into the chip itself. And of course, it's the engineering of the chip that is allowing us to do these 12 billion encrypted transactions with no change to the application set. And we're doing it through the encrypted layer, through a secure container implementation we've done on top of Linux to protect the application if we're running in a container environment. And we're doing that with data at rest, data in motion. The engineering of the machine, including the cryptology module itself, which is you cannot penetrate this module where the keys are stored. If you try to drill something into that module that's even one-tenth the size of a sewing needle, it shuts itself down and destroys all the keys. So there is nothing like this in the world from a security perspective. And then you combine it with the scale of being able to support 2 million Docker containers, a 32 terabyte in-memory database, the size and scale of what you can do. And then if something happens, you've got the ability to just chief HA between the LPER configurations within this machine. And so you don't have to create this very sophisticated, scaled out cloud environment to do that. You know, it's just a resonant part of the capability that's there. And I think this is very powerful for a lot of companies that we see using these new workloads and you know, particularly on, in the case of the Linux environment.
Oh, super cool. Hey, you know what? We have a video of one of these units being made. Why don't we'll show that, and then okay. Let's go let Bam get his licks in.
So what I'd like to talk about as we watch this massively powerful machine get installed on the data center floor is I'm a real, you know, fanboy of machine learning and artificial intelligence, as those who've watched me on Twiet in the past would know. And I obviously, nobody knows more about artificial intelligence than IBM with Watson and the way that's being deployed. And what some folks may not know about IBM is the really amazing work they're doing with the X-Force project, which is the security center of what's going on at IBM as far as IT and enterprise level security. Jamie, could you tell us a little bit about how, you know, mainframe technology is helping drive, you know, security projects like X-Force and injecting AI in a really meaningful way into security?
Well, that's a good question. Of course, our X-Force team are the foremost hackers inside IBM, if you will. They're our expert hackers that really can help us understand what's going on out in the world of security and what's driving a lot of the incidents that you talked about around the world. What we've done on the mainframe is, as it operates, if you will, it also gathers intelligence and data that's integrated into our security event management system based on our QRadar offering. So it becomes a critical data provider, if you will, or for the intelligence that QRadar can then interpret in terms of security event management on an ongoing basis. Clearly, we remain, you know, focused on all of the different things that are happening out there in the environment, including, you know, things like supply chain security, et cetera, and what we need to do around these kinds of environments to better serve our clients.
Well, we've got more to talk about, and we can't wait to get there. But before we do, we've got one more superb advertiser to talk about, and, well, we need Louis Maresca to tell us all about him.
Thanks, guys. Before we get back to This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have to thank another great sponsor, and that is Rocket Mortgage. Now, home buying is not easy. It's quite stressful. I remember buying my last house. It was not fun. I had to deal with multiple banks, different bank reps, different communications all the time. I had to search around my house through all the filing cabinets for all the information I needed, and I had to worry about interest rate hikes. Now, it's nerve-wracking and it seems to take forever. And with the market as unpredictable as it is today, it means interest rates are changing all the time and it causes a lot of anxiety. So this is where our friends at Quicken Loans and Rocket Mortgage noticed all the pitfalls in the process and are starting to do something about it. They're calling it the power buying process. Now, here's how it works. Quicken Loans will verify your income, assets, and credit in less than 24 hours to give you a verified approval. Now, what is that? Well, it gives you the strength of a cash buyer. And in this current market, that's a huge advantage as a buyer because sometimes you have to put offers at a moment's notice, even right at an open house. Now, once you're verified, you qualify for their all-new exclusive Rate Shield approval. Now, first, they'll lock up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. Now, here's the best part. If the rates go up, your rate stays the same. Now, you're probably thinking, well, if the rate goes down, they won't tell me. Nope, that's not true. If the rate goes down, your rate also drops. Now, if you ask me, as a buyer, you seem to have the upper hand here because either way, you win. Now, to get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Rate Shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records, equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. That's rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. And we thank Rocket Mortgage for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now back to you guys.
Well, thanks so much. It's great to be back and have some more questions we want to ask our guest from the IBM Mainframe Group. You know, you were talking about some of the security parameters, and I'm curious, in a world where we hear so much about IT security and the failure of IT security, is that one of the justifications that people ask you about when they are talking to you about going to a mainframe? Is security high on the list of concerns when you're talking to customers and potential customers?
I would say that security is the number one topic when we're talking to existing clients or new clients, frankly. The world around us, the cybersecurity threat becomes more prominent every day. We know that it's being served by organized crime organizations. And so every industry, frankly, is struggling with this. So that is why we have invested so heavily in the security technology, the encryption technology. Within the system, you can imagine as quantum comes to fruition, which my team's also working on quantum computing, which is the bleeding edge here of computing, then we open up other questions around security that, of course, we want to be on the forefront of. So that is the number one question.
Jamie, I'm convinced. IBM fanboy all the way. Love mainframes. I actually kind of miss CICS. If that's weird or not. Anyway, so our viewers are asking, at what point should I start considering a mainframe versus, say, racks and racks and racks of blade servers? You know, help me out on when can I go to my boss and say mainframe actually makes sense? Oh, especially about HR costs, because it's a little different. So two questions: cost of the equipment, and then cost of the care and feeding of the mainframe.
Well, I think that each organization, I think, frankly, Brian, each organization has to look at that total TCO, right? I mean, there's not going to be one formula I can espouse for all organizations, but you do have to look at not just the raw cost of the machine, but the management of the environment. And frankly, with the work we've done to not only create the machine, but also integrate storage technology so fluently into this thing, such that we can get an increased rate of access to the storage, if you will, we've dramatically improved the KEK integration with the storage layer itself. You know, those are the kinds of things that you spend a lot of resources from an operational management dealing with in these really scaled down environments. Now, There's workloads that are more purpose fit for those scale out environments, clearly transactional workloads, database workloads, and even that machine learning context close to the transaction are ideally well suited for a mainframe. I think also organizations which are dealing with fast growing applications around millions of users, where they have to get that scale immediately, you're going to be able to do that a lot more quickly in this kind of environment than some of these scaled out environments.
Well, we have tons of questions that we would like to ask, but we don't have tons of time. So I'm afraid it's time to say farewell to Ms. Jamie Thomas, who is General Manager, Strategy and Development for IBM Systems. Jamie, you've been a great guest today, and we have a couple of final questions. First, is there anything you would like to say to our audience that you haven't had a chance to say already?
Well, I just wanted, I know this has been really centered on the mainframe, which is one of my favorite assets. I did want to put in a plug for a key announcement we made today, which is we made another announcement with Lawrence Livermore Laboratories that it's the number three supercomputer in the world using our Power9 AI-based technology, working with our partner NVIDIA. You may have seen that earlier this year, we also announced the number one supercomputer in the world with this technology, and that was at Oak Ridge National Laboratory. So we announced some new things there today with Lawrence Livermore, so I wanted to put a plug in there. And of course, we didn't get to talk about a lot of the other things that the team is working on, but we really do have cool solutions around storage, software-defined storage, as well as I said before, quantum computing. So happy to come back and spend some more time with you all on some of these other topics in the future.
Well, we will make that a date, because there are all kinds of things from AI to quantum computing that we would love to have a further discussion on. And finally, is there some place that people can keep up with you, a blog, a Twitter account? How can people keep up with your thinking throughout the week?
Well, I am active on Twitter, and you see my Twitter handle there. I am an active Twitter weekly. I try to make sure that keep my followers informed about our announcements, as well as some of the cool things that are happening out there at the events and with clients that I meet with weekly. So I'll look for some of you all out on Twitter. And yes, there's a picture of me with a team in India. They were celebrating a milestone in India recently. And there's a lot of other stuff out there that happy to share with all of you as we navigate our world through the challenging IT industry.
Well, thank you so much for being here. To all our listeners, thank you for being here as well. And for those watching, thanks for putting up with my very spotty video today. We have just a couple of minutes to get the final words from my co-host. We're going to start with Brian McHenry. Brian, what have you got going on this week, and what should people be aware of looking forward?
Well, as always, you can follow me on Twitter, BA McHenry, but also go over to DevCentral at F5.com and check out what our solution architects, what our F5 users are all talking about lately. One thing that I'll just point out is we're participating in DNS Flag Day coming up, and there's some new changes coming out with DNS, and we've got things to help you make those transitions, and as well as make your DNS more secure going over HTTPS and TLS, so DNS D over 8. DOH and D over T, so DNS over TLS. So we can help you make those transitions as well, and some really cool solutions that you can find on DevCentral, which is our user community.
Well, I think Brian McHenry wins the award for most acronym-heavy sign-off, and do go over, follow him, and check out DevCentral. Well, Chiebert? Brian Chi, how about you? I know you've got some travel coming up this week. And how can people keep up with you?
Well, I am ADVNETLAB on Twitter. I'm also Chiebert at twit.tv, but better, why don't you use Twiet at twit.tv? That way it hits all the hosts instead of just me. Love your show suggestions that are coming in. I would love to hear from you on your thoughts on where we can go. I am trying very hard to make sure I slide in startups, because we all want to hear about startups and some of the emerging technology. That little bit of time that I did at the internet too kind of pointed out that while I'm in academia, it occurs to me a lot of really interesting new technology comes up. Emily Lestrange was mentioning that she uses Ansible and things like that. So what do you think? Maybe I should start trying to see if I can get some more of the Internet 2 type of information into the show. What do you think, guys? Anyway, see you next week.
Thanks, Chiebert. As for me, follow me on Twitter at KG4GWA. Follow me with my writing at darkwriting.com. And as always, follow us here every week at Twiet here on Twit TV. Will you spend another week learning all about enterprise technology? When you want to keep up with what's happening in the enterprise, remember to just keep Twiet.